Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Welcome everyone to our webinar, Mindfulness. Is it Christian, Buddhist, or both, and does it matter? Professor Richard Winter is our webinar speaker for tonight. So I just want to say welcome, Richard, and thank you so much for serving us tonight. On behalf of European Leadership Forum, who is the sponsor of Focal Online Webinar Ministry, we want to express our appreciation to Richard for taking his time to minister to us. So today we have Brother Richard. He has a very impressive biography. You can read it on Focal Online. We are so happy to have you, Richard, tonight. We know that your mind is now full.
It is.
So we're just waiting for you to share your thoughts and your heart with us. May God bless you and may God bless your ministry. And thank you for serving us tonight. We are listening.
Thank you, Ovidio. Well, welcome to everyone else from all over the world. And it's great to think of this happening from being compared there in Romania by Ovidio. This is a topic that is huge. It's mindfulness is everywhere. I heard someone saying the other day, there's a feeding frenzy on mindfulness. And I just to tell you a little bit about my own background, I was trained in medicine and psychiatry in England, and then worked with the Labrie Fellowship in England for about 14 years, teaching and studying and counseling. And then the last 23 years, I've been in St. Louis at Covenant Seminary. And I've always seen that my calling has been to work at the interface of psychology, medicine, and theology. And this is another of those areas where, you know, in relation to mindfulness, to try and help us think Christianly about the world and especially about secular psychology and the direction in which it's going. So it's really an exercise in critical and appreciative discernment. Where do we have common ground with mindfulness, and where do we find ourselves as Christians going in a different direction or coming from a different framework? Webinar is really a beginning. There's much more to be done on this topic that I hope to do in the future. This is sort of episode one that we're moving into here. So just historically, to go back a little bit, back to the 1960s, some of you weren't born then, but certainly my life was an interesting one at that time. And I was very aware of the Beatles going off to India and coming back with their insights from Hinduism and Buddhism. And I was aware that spirituality was coming back in again. It was becoming popular after being out in the mental health world for many years since Freud. So spirituality was in, and my wife and I, in that bottom right-hand picture there, set off around the world on our honeymoon for a year, really exploring how was Christianity different from Hinduism and Buddhism. And you can see us there in the foothills of the Himalayas in Nepal and India. That was in the early 70s when we joined the hippie trail in search of why was everyone going to India? What were they looking for there? Now, in the 80s and 90s, the mindful revolution continued. And transcendental meditation and other forms of meditation were introduced into prisons, into businesses, into schools, into the military, sports teams. Bill Moyers, he in this country featured Jon Kabat-Zinn, that we'll hear more about later. And mindfulness was seen then as a real breakthrough in healing the body and the mind. Now, in the academic literature, between 1969 and 1978, if you look at the PubMed search, you could find 10 articles on mindfulness in those 10 years between 69 and 78. Between 1999 and 2008, there were 300 articles. And then between 2009 and 2013, just 4 years, there were almost 2,000 articles. So that gives you a sense of the increasing interest in the academic world. And Jon Kabat-Zinn, the University of Massachusetts Medical Center, started what he called mindfulness-based stress reduction in 1979. Then in the 1990s, Marsha Linehan, developing dialectical behavioral therapy, DBT as it's called, to help suicidal and volatile and challenging patients, found mindfulness was really helpful for them. In the 1995, the cognitive therapies, which were focusing on changing your thinking patterns, especially for depression, began to use mindfulness. So they developed mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. And dramatic results were published in the early 2000s, claiming that mindfulness cut the relapse rate of depression by half. It helped enormously in anxiety. It boosted willpower and prevented relapses in addictions. And just yesterday, I read an article of that mindfulness is being used for drug-resistant epilepsy. And they're claiming that it improves the quality of life greatly for these people. So, and then if you move on into the contemporary figures who speak about this and do webinars on this, teach about it, Andrew Weil with his Center for Integrative Medicine in Arizona, and his many books on food, on medicine, on depression, mindfulness. Jack Kornfield, down in the middle there at the bottom of the picture. Dan Siegel on the right there. Ron Siegel, not related to Dan Siegel, but I'll be quoting him a little later on. So it's everywhere. It's in books, DVDs, apps on your phone. It's a huge industry. And Google has taken it on, marketed it as a personal stress reduction. The claim, of course, is that training in mindfulness produces resilience to stress and trauma. Dan Siegel, in working with brain science in the neuroscience of well-being, mindfulness, and love that you can see at the bottom there on the right, he discovered that all the things he was finding about the brain and what helped healing and integration were strongly paralleled in Buddhist meditation and mindfulness. When he started his work, he didn't realize the parallels, but now he sees the strong relationship that he's actually producing the same result with his therapy as mindfulness is producing. Now, there have been Buddhist protests at all of this because the Buddhists are saying, you know, you're cheapening this mindfulness business. It's not just a quick fix for all your problems. It's not just a quick and easy solution. And Mary Sykes Wiley, who writes commentaries in Psychotherapy Networker magazine, very thoughtful person, says what was once a powerful philosophical discipline intended to help free people from greed, ill will, and delusion became just another mass-marketed self-fulfillment tool. So she is somewhat critical of the way in which it has become part of the marketplace of healing techniques. And you can see here in this cover of the Psychotherapy Networker the beginnings of this relationship back in the 70s between psychotherapy and Buddhism and enlightenment. And then the more recent one, in a sense, now they have come to realize that we can work together. So there is a lot of articles, a lot of research done on the effect of mindfulness in relation to psychotherapy. Another networker cover not so long ago, Mindfulness Goes Viral, What Would the Buddha Say? And in January 2015, there was an article in the New York Times talking about the number of books on mindfulness, mindful work, mindful birthing, The Mindful Teen, The Mindful Way Through Stress, and on, covering many different areas. This was a Scientific American Mind magazine a while back, I think it was in 2013. Notice the title here, Sharpen Your Focus, How the Science of Mindfulness Can Improve Attention and Lift Your Mood. And the and in the actual article, they say this, waves of emotion may roil the surface, but 30 feet down, all is peaceful. By tuning to every breath as it travels through your body, you can dive into that basal oasis. That was an article by Sandra Upson. Now then, we must come to the question of what is mindfulness? And I know there are a number of people on this webinar who have experience in this and are psychotherapists, and I presume there are some who have no experience of it. So the basics of what is mindfulness? It is a striving to focus on the present, as this says. And in that, in the middle there, you see John Kabat-Zinn's definition. Mindfulness means paying attention in a particular way, on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. Paying attention on purpose, in the present moment, and non-judgmentally. So one of the very simple exercises that people are often given as they're introduced to mindfulness is to take a raisin or a slice of an orange, and just to keep it, hold it in your hand, and to look at it and notice the wrinkles on the surface of the raisin and the texture of its skin, and then to smell it, and to be aware of any scent that may come from it, and to be aware of its silence as it sits there. It doesn't speak to you. It doesn't make a sound. And then after you have become aware of all those things, to put it on your tongue and just to hold it there on the tongue and to let it rest there and feel the juice maybe beginning to come out of it in the moisture on your tongue. And very slowly then to bite into it, just one bite, and notice what you taste and what you feel. And then maybe in a minute or so, another bite, and just notice what you taste. And then eventually until you swallow it. So the purpose of this, obviously, is to make you stop, to slow down, to look, to listen, to taste, to feel, to smell, to heighten your awareness. So awareness of the present moment, paying attention. Most of us just gobble our food down. Or when we're walking through a garden, we notice it briefly, but we don't. We rarely stop to smell the roses, as we say, or to listen to the birds in the trees. So it's really stopping, paying attention. And paying attention. So the folk into mindfulness would say, this is our entire society is on autopilot. We're so busy doing that we don't know how to be. We're more asleep than awake. We are thinking too much. Our minds are always busy that we're not really aware of what's going on around us. So we need to learn, as they say, how to not fall asleep, but how to fall awake. Into a true awakeful awareness. And one of the ways they often use is to, first of all, to center down and to focus on your breathing. So you sit quietly in a chair and notice your breath going in and out of your lungs, through your nose, maybe in through your nose, out through your mouth. A simple breathing exercise. And then as you do that, you open up and become aware of the sounds, the sensations in your body, the ideas going on inside you, the thoughts, the feelings. And you just observe, you watch what comes and goes. You don't judge or interpret. You stay with it. You live in the moment, paying attention, as they would say, to the garden of now. And in order to do this effectively, you need to do it for 20 to 45 minutes a day or more. So this is a pretty strong discipline. Now, we know that the first stage there, the breathing, calms your autonomic nervous system, the normal fight-flight response of anxiety. It balances the fight-flight part of your nervous system with the calming side, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic sides. And it also seems to repeated practice strengthens the prefrontal cortex and the ability to remain calm in stressful situations. So there's the breathing, and then the actual noticing of the thoughts, as someone who says it has talked about a lazy river exercise. Just imagine you're sitting by a lazy, slow-moving river, and you notice little boats going by, just drifting, and some of them have names on them. And you just let them drift. I like to use the image of watching clouds. And you notice that you're tense, you're anxious, or you're a little bit irritated with someone, or you're upset that something didn't happen that you were expecting to happen on time. And you just notice it, and you let it pass. You don't reach out and grab it and engage with it and fight with it and say, I shouldn't be thinking that thought, or that person makes me really angry. I've got to go out and sort them out. So it's a sort of a being still in the presence of whatever comes up. And for the Christian, there are obviously strong parallels here with what we often call as the quiet time. You take 20 minutes every morning or evening, and you spend time meditating on scripture and praying and being still in the presence of God. Now, we'll come back to Christian meditation much later. Another way that the mindfulness folk would talk about this is that this enables you to be free from your monkey mind, the unstoppable stream of plans and worries that pour through your mind, and you keep replaying them time and again as you go through the day. So this is an awareness of self and of the world around you. It's a sort of cultivating intimacy with yourself, your body. What are you feeling? Where are you feeling sensations, your emotions, your thoughts? And one thing that we often realize as we do this is how self-focused we are, how self-critical we tend to be. Our thoughts tend to be around what we can get. And the more you slow down and enter into this world, you begin then to feel connection with everyone else. And it leads then, they would say, to much greater compassion, kindness, gratitude to oneself and to others. And it enables you, especially in counseling, to mindfully listen to other people. You're less distracted. You're more able to focus on another person. So it's noticing those angry thoughts or those frustration thoughts or anxious thoughts, depressive thoughts, and not identifying with them. It's not jumping, I am angry or I am anxious, and that's bad, and I've got to do something about that. It's much more saying, gosh, look at that angry feeling that I'm experiencing, that anxious thought that I'm having. Just let it go past as I sit in this mindfulness practice. Now, back to Jon Kabat-Zinn. Here he's, as I say, developed his mindfulness-based stress reduction at the University of Massachusetts Medical School. This is an 8-week program of yoga practices, 45-minute guided home meditation practiced 6 times a week, and then an all-day retreat in the 6th week. And the people who come to this would be taught a set of self-regulation skills. So it's learning to regulate your emotions and your thinking. Now, Mary Sykes Wiley, this commentator I mentioned earlier, writing in the Psychotherapy Networker earlier this year, says, commenting on the history of mindfulness, said that Jon Kabat-Zinn decided to use what Buddhists call skillful means, teaching Buddhist principles and practices, but disguising their origin in plain American-style talk, promoting a kind of stealth Buddhism, scrubbed clean of bells, chants, prayers, and terms like Dharma, Karma, and Dukkha, not to mention the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, and so on. And then she quotes Jon Kabat-Zinn himself saying, "I bent over backward to structure it and find ways to speak about it that avoided as much as possible the risk of being seen as Buddhist, New Age, Eastern mysticism, or just plain flaky." And he, in January this year, was at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland, leading executives in mindfulness exercises. And he makes this grand claim. He says, "Mindfulness can save and grace and transform and heal our lives and has repercussions far beyond us as individuals." That's a pretty grand claim, isn't it? He says, "Mindfulness is the final common pathway to what makes us human, so it is super important." So he's claiming that this is the road to truth about real reality. And he promises that it is an answer to much of the anger and hatred in the world today, that we can spread compassion and love and creativity and gratitude in dead. So that's his program of mindfulness-based stress reduction. You can find many talks by him on YouTube. It's very available. Now, there has been an evolution, as I mentioned earlier, of cognitive behavioral therapy in the 70s and the 80s to mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So in the beginning, when we were trying to help people, we were trying to help them to change their thinking, their behavior. And now we are saying that actually, if you help people to observe and accept their thoughts and feelings, rather than trying to fight them or get rid of them, that allowing them to exist paradoxically takes away their power. And there is some truth in this. It is a paradoxical thing that sometimes if you actually tell someone to be anxious or be depressed or to stutter more, if they're a stutterer, that they can't actually do it. And we'll come back to that theme in just a moment. But to think for a moment about the studies on this, the studies show the effectiveness of mindfulness for many disorders. And the National Institute of Health has funded many, more than 50 studies on this. I'm sure it's a lot more than that now. One example of this is Buddhist monks who were longtime meditators were compared with controls who had just a week in mindfulness meditation. So long-term meditators versus those who are just doing it for a week. And they found in the Buddhist monks this incredible large-scale coordination of the neural circuits. They found persistent increased activity in the left prefrontal cortex, which is associated with joyful and serene emotions. And intriguingly, they found that these monks had greater antibody response to the flu vaccine. So there were not only brain-based changes, but also in the rest of the body seemed to be made more healthy. Now, the question comes, do these curative claims hold up? An interesting review and meta-analysis done, published in 2014 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, reviewed nearly 20,000 trials involving mindfulness and winnowed this down to 47 that they said met the criteria for good research, which shows you how much bad research is being done. And they said there was moderately strong evidence that mindfulness meditation had a small but consistent benefit in relieving anxiety, depression, and pain. and depression was relieved 10 to 20%. And they claimed that it showed that it was as good as antidepressants, especially in chronic depression. Another meta-analysis, an earlier one than this one in 2014, came out more positively than this one. So the West views it, has come to view mindfulness as a quick fix tool. The East views it as a lifelong practice in a rich spiritual, ethical, and social framework. Mary Sykes Wiley again says, this is in January 2015, while meditation has been acclaimed and sold as a quick, no-risk, easily mastered technique to achieve just about any conceivable desired goal, health, happiness, freedom from physical or mental pain, relaxation, self-confidence, career success, sexual success, inner peace, world peace, it's in fact a far deeper, more complex, and less well understood process than most people realize. So what, back to mindfulness in daily life, to underline some of the things we said earlier. It's basically, as I said, about slowing down, paying attention, stopping, paying attention to what's going on in me, especially my self-critical thoughts, my negative reactions to others, breathing to release the physical tension, to allow the negative thoughts to soften, to have more compassion, and then to reflect, what's the pattern here? What lies am I believing about myself or about other people or about the world around me? How have I been conditioned by my earlier life to believe these things? And what may be happening inside the other? And then as a result of this slowing down, you can then react in a more loving, with a more loving, respectful, and skillful response. So this is learning to live mindfully, non-judgmentally, they would say, being non-reactive, empathic, compassionate to self and others. So you name and tame your internal world. And the mindfulness folk hope that the mindfulness states that you achieve will become character traits and become much more long-lasting, that your brain will become more integrated. And this is where we need to teach, they would say, and I would agree with this too, that learning to regulate your emotions, to slow down and be aware of what's going on. It's what Dan Siegel is wanting to help people to do. And he suggests that to develop social and emotional intelligence, we need to be teaching children not just the 3 hours of reading and writing and arithmetic, but we need to be teaching them reflection. And I think that's a great point, to self-reflect. Why am I feeling this? How should I react? So rather than jumping into the fight-flight response, it's much more the pause and plan response. And Dan Siegel says that a lot of the traits of mindfulness are found in people who have secure attachment in childhood. Their neurons are well integrated, and they have a much more reasonable response time to stress when they have been in childhood, as he would say, seen, safe, soothed, and secure. Seen, safe, soothed, and secure. Other people have put it in daily life that this is a process of, you might say, of watching and weeding. You become more aware of what you're feeling. You turn down the anxiety alarm of the amygdala, and you learn to let go of the old patterns of response. You would not learn to ignore the old paths that your brain took you in. You do this pausing and planning that I mentioned, and then you need to plant and feed the more positive traits of compassion and love and gratitude and forgiveness and so on, and to counter the lies and to walk new paths. So to be able to become aware of the self-critical thoughts, I never get anything right, or nobody pays attention to me, or I am not good enough. It must be my fault. And to see that there are other ways of thinking. Now, this is very close to cognitive therapy, the old style of cognitive therapy. And I think there is much good in this. This is what I would call common grace wisdom. It's understood by many people of different religious traditions, different philosophical traditions. So this is an aspect of common growth wisdom that brings healing and integration of the brain for all. Just as the sun shines and the rain falls on the Christian and the non-Christian, so these are methods of calming the mind that are available to all. And Dan Siegel and others in the brain science world, which goes along with the mindfulness world very strongly in our culture at the moment, recognizes that if we direct our attention, we have the power to shape our brain's firing patterns, as well as the power to shape the architecture of the brain itself. So what we think, how we think, changes the brain. Mental activity stimulates brain firing as much as brain firing creates mental activity. What is often said, what fires together, wires together. So in exercising this mindful attention, we are exercising, in a sense, new brain muscles, just as we exercise physical muscles for our physical health. So learning mindfulness techniques can strengthen the hub of the mind so that internal sensations such as body signals or waves of emotion can be experienced with more clarity and calmness. As one person put it, I had this amazing realization after practicing mindfulness. I can feel this change. My thoughts and feelings come up, sometimes big, sometimes bad, that they used to feel like who I was. And now they're becoming more like an experience I'm having, not who I am. They don't define who I am. Now, we need to go a little behind the benefits, the practical benefits on the brain and the body and the mind of mindfulness, to look at the story that lies behind it in Buddhist philosophy and ideas. Here's an example from Tara Brach in a book called Radical Acceptance, Embracing Your Life with the Heart of the Buddha. And we're really saying that the Buddhist, just like the Christian, is asking the big questions of life. Especially, why do we suffer? That's the big preoccupation of Buddhism. But behind that is the question of, where have I come from as a human being? Where am I going to? Why do I suffer the way I do? Why do we have the problems that we do? And where are we going to? How do we solve those problems? These are the big questions of life. What is truth and reality? And in this book, Tara Brach says, for all of us, the path of befriending our experience requires great gentleness and patience. As we learn to meet whatever arises in our body, heart, and mind with radical acceptance, we discover a precious freedom. Rather than being identified as a defended and insufficient self, we come to trust what Buddhists call our Buddhist nature, the awareness and love that are our true essence. We discover the wisdom, wholeness, and love that are our deepest nature. In a way, what she's saying here is that underneath the facade of our lives, if we could only discover it, that really we are perfect the way we are. Now, let's go a little bit deeper into Buddhist mindfulness. Now, the meditation technique, which is often disconnected from the philosophy today, was introduced by Gautama Buddha about 2,500 years ago. And it is often called Vipassana meditation, insight meditation. Mindfulness is one of the eight noble truths of Buddhism, number 7. And they would say that mental disciplines are used to achieve uninterrupted mindfulness for the purpose of reaching a heightened level of spiritual awareness. So Ron Siegel, who is one of the contemporary exponents of psychotherapy and mindfulness, says this: in the Buddhist traditions, from which many contemporary mindfulness practices derive, mindfulness techniques evolved as tools for deconstructing our usual view of ourselves and the world, for waking up from conventional, socially reinforced fictions about who we are and how to find happiness. This awakening occurs to the degree that we no longer believe in the self. It involves realizing anatta, or non-self. And the three poisons that Buddhists would point to are anger, greed, and ignorance. Anger, greed, and ignorance. And we'll see a little more of how these develop. And here we're getting into more complex things that I am only really beginning to understand myself as I read and listen and study on this topic. But Buddhist mindfulness enables you to become aware of things as they really are. In other words, it helps you to see true reality, and in that you find true freedom. And four very significant truths are, firstly, that all life is suffering, or dukkha. Believing that things should be different brings suffering. Desiring that things are different brings suffering. Most suffering, they would say, comes from trying to avoid suffering. Chris Germer and Kristen Neff, talking about self-compassion, say, when you suffer, you need to be able to say to yourself, this is a moment of suffering. Suffering is a part of life. May I be kind to myself? So not trying to escape it, but rather embracing the suffering that you are in and learning to be kind while you are in it. And recognizing that you are not alone in suffering, that everyone else in the world suffers as well. And in that, you have compassion for yourself and compassion for everyone else. The story of the Buddha, in fact, Prince Siddhartha, is one of Buddha. His parents tried to keep him from seeing suffering and gave him and his wife a beautiful palace to live in, and he never went out of the palace until one day he did go out and he saw an old man. And another day he saw a sick man and then a dead man. And he was really horrified and didn't know what to make of this. And then he saw a saint and decided that he wanted to be like the latter and left the luxury of his wealthy background to seek for truth and enlightenment, which he found after a prolonged period of meditation in an experience of enlightenment where these truths came to him. The second truth here is the transitory nature of all things, riding the wave of experience. So as you ride the wave of experience or flow with the clouds across the sky or the on the river, you can make more intelligent choices of actions. You're not ruled by your feelings. I am not my anger. I am not my anxiety or my depression. You accept whatever comes, and ultimately that brings peace. Then the third one is there's no I to be found, just the unfolding of moment-by-moment experience. Trying to construct a coherent self is a source of suffering, because then you get attached to things, attached to your feelings, attached to people around you. You have what would say many selves in your thoughts and feelings versus the Western idea, individualistic idea of a personal identity. As Wai Wu Wei said, a Taoist philosopher, why are you unhappy? Because 99.9% of everything you think and everything you do is for yourself, and there isn't one. Now that is going to the sort of extreme monistic thinking where all is one and we may come back to that in the discussion. And then the final point here is being open to suffering and willing to help others in their pain and recognizing that everyone else is suffering and therefore being able to have compassion for oneself and for others. So Ron Siegel, commenting on this idea of selflessness, says, when we relate to each moment as the impersonal unfolding of changing experience in the field of awareness, rather than my joy or my sorrow, we can face our adversity with less resistance. We have to accept what is. Liberation comes from realizing it's all a passing show. It's only my desire to be significant that's causing suffering. If I can embrace my insignificance, it's all okay. So as one of 7 billion people alive here today on one tiny planet in a vast universe, we really are pretty darn insignificant. Now, I know I'm putting together a number of quotes on that topic here, and there's a danger of taking them out of context, but I think I'm being fair to the overall thread of the direction in which this is going. Here is an example of someone describing the nature of their mystical experience of enlightenment. This is a Michael Baim in a Tibetan Buddhist meditation. He says, there was a feeling of energy centered within me, going out to infinite space and returning. There was a relaxing of the dualistic mind and an intense feeling of love. I felt a profound letting go of the boundaries around me and a connection with some kind of energy and state of being that had the quality of clarity, transparency, and joy. I felt a deep and profound sense of connection to everything, recognizing that there never was a true separation at all. Notice the relaxing of the dualistic mind, a sense of no boundaries. And this is a theme of Ken Wilber, who's one of the leading transpersonal therapists from a Buddhist background. He says the ultimate metaphysical secret, if we dare to state it so simply, is that there are no boundaries in the universe. Boundaries are illusions, products not of reality, but of the way we map and edit reality. And while it's fine to map out territory, it's fatal to confuse the two. And this takes us into this Buddhist belief that ultimately, monistic belief, that all is one. If you could really see this and achieve this level of enlightenment, which most people don't, then you lose the boundary between you and me, between God and me, between right and wrong, between creator and creation. Ultimately, John Kabat-Zinn says, you are already whole. There is nothing to do or to attain. So I must have just a little more to take you through here, but hopefully not for too long. But what it, in contrast to this, in reflecting on this from a Christian perspective, what is the Christian answer to suffering? And if Christianity is true, then it seems to me it is a very different perspective than Buddhism. Because Christianity says that the creation was made by, there is a personal God. This is a personal universe. It's not an impersonal reality. That he has given us each in the creation a significant eternal identity. We are not selfless. There is an identity, and boundaries between us and God, between each other, are real. And then suffering comes into that perfect world as a result not of ignorance of our perfect state, but of rebellion against the Creator. And we are creatures now. Part of our reality is an experience of being, having great as being made in his image, but also sadly great depravity as being very broken and much that takes us away from what God would want for us. So we suffer as a result of our own rebellion, as the result of Adam and Eve's rebellion in the beginning, the fall, and as a result of other people's sinning against us and causing us to suffer. And redemption comes because God himself came into the world in the person of Christ and suffers with and for us. And he gives us a new identity in our union with Christ. There's a sense in which we do become one with God, not that we lose our identity in that, but that, and that one day we will be made perfect, but it will be in a relationship of love. The whole Bible, in a sense, is the message of a love of God loving us so much and pursuing us, but that identity is not lost completely in him. So as I think about mindfulness, I see it as something good, but that something that may lead us, the deeper you go into Buddhist beliefs behind it, in the wrong direction. In aspect of God's good creation, the ability to reflect, to be still, to slow down, but it has been adopted within a false framework of reality. Can people find healing without God? Yes, of course they can. There's the common grace gift of healing a body for non-Christians by non-Christians doctors. In the same way, mindfulness can bring a measure of integration and healing of the brain. And I think we can reclaim and use it within a Christian framework of reality, much in the way that we use behaviorist techniques. We reject the behaviorist philosophy that we are nothing but stimulus response machines or animals, but we can use the techniques of desensitization and many of the techniques that come out of behaviorism in a very positive way, because they are part of the laws that are written into the creation that God has made. So what is biblical meditation? Briefly, I think it is meditation, it is learning to be still, to slow down and know that there is a creator God. So it's in a relational context with God and the indwelling spirit. It's not just with myself. And there is a long historical tradition of centering prayer and contemplative prayer in the church, with through the Desert Fathers and many others up into our contemporary times, that I think we have sadly ignored in much of the evangelical church, but some people are rediscovering again. The Jesus prayer, for example, of Jesus Christ, Son of God, have mercy upon me. Now that can be used as a mystical mantra to create a state of mind, or it can be used in a real sense of a prayer of relationship, asking God to have mercy on us and having an experience of his grace as he does just that. So it's stopping, being in the presence of God, allowing distracting thoughts to float by and not engage with them. It's taking a break from the normal ways of being, of multitasking, of thinking and busily doing. It's allowing God to be God and you are not. It's taking a brief vacation from our pressured selves. We don't have to believe everything that we think or feel. Being comfortable with silence, hearing the love song of God for us. Exposing ourselves to his presence, his invitation to change. It's a doorway through brokenness to an awareness of deep sinfulness. It's opening our hearts to receive the healing grace of God and enjoying the pleasure of his company. And it is meditating on who he is and the reality that he has made, his creation, but also on the scriptures, which are his word to us, the way we know him. So it is, and we can meditate on his word by just contemplating a phrase or a verse, or perhaps just by getting inside the characters of a story in the scripture. So there is plenty about the importance of biblical meditation. Blessed is the person whose delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates, she meditates day and night. My soul will be satisfied, my mouth will praise you, when I remember you upon my bed and meditate on you in the watches of the night. And I think Buddhist meditation is mindfulness is only on the creation on myself or on the external creation. It's not on the Creator and his desires for us. It's not on the Maker's instructions of how we should live and be. So we need our minds renewed, and God has promised to do that in these verses in Romans 12 and Hebrews 10. And we know that he has promised that he will, in a sense, give us his mind. The more we cooperate with the Spirit, allow him to fill us, that we have the mind of Christ. And the Buddhist Ron Siegel points out that in Buddhism and many traditions, mind and heart are the same word. And in a sense, in the Hebrew tradition, that is true. The mind is part of the heart, which is that which with which we focus on God and relate to him. So as I finish here, just a brief reflection on the personal universe in which we live and how we deal with suffering. What is the Father heart of God for us in this world? And I think he says to us, as I seek to listen to him, that you are made in my image. You are profoundly significant and unique to love, to create, to speak, to dance. And I hate the evil and injustice in the world. I love all that is good and beautiful. I came into the world to set you free from guilt and from shame, to undo all the effects of rebellion and sin. I came into your world and I suffered the ultimate humiliation for you. This is the answer to suffering. The Son of God who came on a rescue mission of love, as Ed Welsh says in his book on shame. He was misunderstood, insulted, betrayed, denied, mocked, spit on, cursed, abandoned, stripped, and crucified for us. So he accepts us just as we are, both good and bad, messed up, broken, traumatized, victim, violator, deprived, depraved, an internal war zone in your heart, in all your glory and grief, all your dignity and depravity. He says, I love you and delight in you so much that I intend to transform you more and more to be like me, and to work against and heal all the causes and consequences of evil and sin. And one day I will come to heal completely and establish justice on the earth. For now, go and bring good news to the poor. Bind up the brokenhearted. Proclaim liberty to captives. Proclaim the day of vengeance of our God. Comfort all who mourn. And live in the light of that day that Isaiah talks about in chapters 61 to 66. Where everything sad, as Sam Ganji said in The Lord of the Rings, everything sad is going to come untrue. I've taken you through a lot here, and I know that you may have many questions and comments. I'm just looking through the comments and questions. So someone says, I like the idea of taking a break from multitasking and hearing the love song of God. I want to set up centering prayer groups in Stockholm for those who are attracted to Buddhist ideas. People want to meditate, and I want to bring in Jesus, Ignatian prayer, and scripture truths. That's from Nancy there. And then from, are there writings about centering prayer among believers? Yes, there are. And I gave you some names there. There we go. Keating, Menninger, Pennington. These are names of people that it would be worth exploring. Oh, tools for anxiety sufferers. well, there are, I think the basic one in terms of meditation is this idea of being able to slow yourself down. And for a start, breathing exercises are the very basic tool for anxiety, so that this slows down your alarm system in your body, the sympathetic fight-flight response, that whenever you get into anxiety situations, when you can't sleep, that's often what I use it for, I breathe And there are various ways of doing this, but to breathe in through your nose to slightly briefer, and then hold the breath and then let it out in a long, slow expiration through your mouth. Some people say that you breathe in for a count of four, hold it for a count of seven, and then out for a count of eight, slowly breathing out. And with it, breathing out the worries and the tensions and the anxious thoughts. So that's the beginning. And then muscle relaxation, going through the whole body, relaxing, can be a part of this too, tightening each part of the body and then relaxing. And as you relax, feel the tension flowing out. And then the observing of your thoughts and of your body, where you feel the tension, and not just grabbing the thoughts, but allowing them to pass across your mind, and letting them go. So that, for example, someone with obsessive compulsive disorder who has these compulsive thoughts, they basically have to retrain their brain, because the brain is giving them false messages that I need to check that the door is locked 20 times or 50 times or whatever it is, or I need to wash 50 times, otherwise I'll get some terrible disease. And they have to learn to calm themselves in this way and to be able to tell themselves that what I'm thinking is a lie, and rather than grabbing hold of that thought and acting on it, then letting it pass across their consciousness until it disappears out the other side. And that's really hard to do for OCD folk. But those are some examples, and there are others. If basically with anxiety, you can't run away from it completely. You have to face it in some way and walk through it and find ways to calm yourself when you're walking through it. Another question about going back to, I know about Keating and Desert Fathers, but what about more recent efforts? Are there people doing this now in Europe? You know, I think people could probably from Europe could answer that better than I could. Maybe there are some that can do that for us. Could I clarify my answer to the third question in the title? I need to go back and remind myself of what the title is at this point. Is it Christian, Buddhist, or both? And does it matter? I would say, yes, it matters a lot. And that's what I tried to lay out in what I was saying, in that we need to recognize that the Buddhist view of reality is very different from the Christian view in terms of where suffering comes from and is there a God and is it a personal or an impersonal universe that we live in. If Christianity is true, then they can't both be true at the same time. And I believe that Buddhism actually takes people away from reality and truth. But in the area of mindfulness, there is common ground that we can appreciate as part of our common humanity, that both Buddhists and Christians find things about how we're made that are really true to the way we're made, so that the mindfulness techniques to learn to relax and to learn to deal with uncomfortable emotions. Now, I think we need to think through each emotion from a Christian perspective and say, how does the Bible teach us to deal with anger or with anxiety or with depression or with lust? And say, where does mindfulness take us in that? How far can we go? And where does it actually take us away from Christian practice? And maybe that's going to be something I need to do more of in the future. Okay, just going to these questions here. I hope some of you have got the book on Christian Meditation, Practicing the Presence of God by James Finley, Table of Inwardness by Calvin Miller. Thank you for those. How do you respond to clients who experience mindfulness with increased anxiety? The process of slowing down is actually scary and triggering. That's a great question, Lindsay. And we haven't talked about some of the dangers of mindfulness. And the teachers of mindfulness do recognize there are dangers. And they recognize that for some people, as they become aware of things inside them, that is pretty scary. You know, they've spent their whole life pushing against it, trying to run from anxieties that may be below the surface, trying to distract themselves, trying not to think about it. And as you take them to a place where they begin to have unconscious things surface, that can be very scary and disturbing. So as with all forms of treatment for trauma, especially, you have to go slow. You can't rush into this. And it may be that you have to just teach basic breathing and basic muscle relaxation and introduce it very slowly so that they get maybe just a little part of the traumatic memories or experiences and anxiety that may surface can be dealt with at a time. So that's a great point that you make. I'm getting a lot of questions now. What is the difference in the Psalms where David grieves a loss and feels an emotion deeply, and the idea of letting an anxiety pass? Kathy, that's a great question, and I've been thinking about this myself because I came across a quote the other day about grief. And actually, a long time ago, many years ago, I went to visit a Buddhist monastery in England and was sitting on a carpet drinking tea in front of this huge statue of Buddha. And I said to the Buddhist monk there, I said, how do I deal with grief? What happens if my wife dies? Should I be so unattached to her, which would be the Buddhist philosophy of non-attachment, of non-desire? Should I be so detached that I don't feel sadness if she dies? And he just laughed. And I think part of that was a recognition that this is a point of tension, because the official philosophy of Buddhism would be, and here I quote from one expert in this field, "Not from weeping nor from grieving will anyone obtain peace of mind. On the contrary, his pain will be the greater and his body will suffer. He will make himself sick and pale, yet the dead are not saved by his lamentation. He who seeks peace should draw out the arrow of lamentation and complaint and grief. He who has drawn out the arrow and has become composed will obtain peace of mind. He who has overcome all sorrow will become free from sorrow and be blessed." And I think that in this world, we will suffer grief. We suffer loss. And I think we think of Jesus at the tomb of Lazarus and his deep grief at losing his friend, his anger at the face of death. And there's another emotion where Paul says, be angry, but don't sin. Whereas the Buddhist would say that anger itself is a poison and that you want to avoid all anger. Even, I think they seem to be saying, righteous anger at injustice and evil. You become passive and accepting and loving of all your experiences so that they don't ruffle the surface. Now there are different interpretations of Buddhist teaching as I read all of this and talk with people, but I hope that gives some answer. So I think David's grief and grieving is a very real human emotion that is not to be suppressed. There are some people, obviously, who go on too long in grief and cannot let go of it. But I think grief is part of living in a fallen world. Joanna, you asked, there's a danger of detachment with Buddhist meditation. Is that a danger as well with Christian meditation that is rooted in the reality of God? Could we eventually take our emotions too lightly and not listen to them? I think I've sort of answered that in my last response, and that is my concern, and I want to do more study on this to try and get my mind around it a little more. But here is a response from one person talking about anger. If you don't know how to treat yourself with compassion, how can you treat another person with compassion? When anger arises, continue to practice mindful breathing and mindful walking to generate the energy of mindfulness. Continue to embrace tenderly the energy of anger within you. Anger may continue to be there for some time, but you are safe because the Buddha is in you, helping you to take good care of your anger. The energy of mindfulness is the energy of the Buddha. When you practice mindful breathing and embrace your anger, you are under the protection of the Buddha. There is no doubt about it. The Buddha is embracing you and your anger with a lot of compassion. Now, that's intriguing on two counts. One, the very sort of like a personal relationship with the Buddha, when the Buddhists would say there is no God. Buddha doesn't in reality exist. That's just we are part of the Buddha nature. We become one with whatever is, with the Buddha, with each other. But it does seem to me to be a devaluing of righteous anger, that if you hold the anger, treat yourself with compassion, embrace it with love, that it will pass and you won't feel then compelled to respond in any violent or hateful way. So I'm looking back up the questions here to see if there are any I have missed. I think that's all of them that I have here. Any others? Sorry, I'm just trying to get these questions. Someone says, could I walk you through how to respond to someone who is fearful? Well, I think I did that a little earlier on in talking about breathing and muscle relaxation, dealing with fear. And then obviously then you have to deal with the specific fear. It depends a lot on what the fear is, whether it's an OCD type fear that I was talking about, or whether it is a social phobia, or whether it is, a fear of flying. And that would be dealing with it in, I would use breathing, relaxation, and desensitization techniques to help them to get over. So gradually being exposed to the fear, and maybe a fear of not being heard or seen. That fear, of course, is a much more internal one, isn't it? It's not a fear of an actual object. It's more it's a fear of what I'm thinking. I'm afraid that people are thinking of me. And I think that would take you deeply into helping people to think about where are the roots of that fear in their past, in their own story. How have they been treated in the past? What are the situations that trigger that thinking? And helping them when they do get into that, and this is where the mindfulness bit comes in, to calm themselves and not just react with escape, but actually facing the fear and moving in with breathing, with relaxation, moving into a place where they think they might not be heard or seen, and being willing to take the risk that of moving into relationship with other people where they're afraid that might not happen. And in a sense, having experiences where it's not true and where other people can tell them that they are heard and seen. So it involves risking being in relationship and even in a group therapy session where other people can give some feedback. There are more questions coming in here. Let me just go back up. A number of questions about centering prayer approaches. I think these are the main ones here. Yeah, centering prayer. Let me just go back to that slide here. I didn't go into that very deeply. I think in our tradition, in evangelical Protestant world, we tend to be very focused on bringing our long lists of requests to God, or having a lot of content in our prayers of thanksgiving and so on, and praise. And all of those are good, but I think the idea in centering and contemplative prayer is of being able to be still in the presence of God and listening to him. And you might just take one phrase of scripture, one little a word, perhaps the names of God that you might meditate on or contemplate on. You might take the story of Jesus on the road to Emmaus and imagine yourself as one of the disciples. Morton Kelsey has a good example of this in one of his books. Just imagining, rather than just thinking about the passage or exegeting it in a formal way, but actually really allowing your imagination to play. What was it like? If I was one of those disciples and I met Jesus in that situation? Now, and the Jesus prayer, repeating, Jesus, Son of God, have mercy on me. The dangers of that, someone asked, the danger is that it moves over into a mystical, ritualistic prayer where you are chanting or singing or saying a phrase or a word or even a charismatic chorus again and again and again, that you put yourself into a trance state, almost self-hypnosis, and you think this is the presence of God, when it is just a trance state that could happen in any, in many parts of the world. Repetitive chants and dancing and singing are used in many religious rituals to get into a trance state. And I think you can mistake that from actually being in the presence of God. So there's a danger that it moves over into that. But the other danger from the evangelical side is that we neglect this sort of meditation and taking time to be still in the presence of God and to know that he really is God. So I think that's what I would say in response to that. It's certainly good to get these to stimulate me to think more, and I will go on working on this topic and hopefully have more clarity each time I do something on it. Could you share a bit? Here's another one. Could you share a bit about how you suggest mindfulness practices to a client? I would tend to use it in the context of teaching breathing and relaxation and as sort of a means of focusing the mind. And I would use the word mindfulness, but I would want to, as I've said the whole way through here, put it in the context of a Christian view of reality. It's a bit like using yoga. I think there's a parallel here, that yoga is great for physical exercise, for stretching, for getting fit, for yoga, Pilates. I'm all for those. I do them myself to try and keep my body and mind fit. The ultimate aim of yoga in Hinduism is to actually that you should reach a state of enlightenment where you come to this monistic worldview that all is one. But it's a slow process that through various exercises of body and mind and awakening the chakras in your spine to the point where you have an experience of enlightenment eventually. That is taking it into its Hindu roots and its the belief system behind it. Now, I still think you can practice yoga or you can practice mindfulness at the level of a a tool to train the mind and the neurons. Much of the work that's coming out in brain science today from Dan Siegel and others, I think is very compatible with a Christian worldview that says your thinking can actually change your brain circuits and structures. So the more you think in the way that you were made to think by God, the more Christ-like you become in your attitudes and your actions, your thinking, the more it will change your brain to open up pathways in that direction. So this is what we would call sanctification. It's the daily, little by little discipline of godliness, of living the way God intends us to live, living in his grace and in his love and responding to him. And in doing that, we become more Christ-like in our minds. The question is Philippians 4, an example of a mindful approach. Let me just get the exact quote here, because I think you're right on there, Kathy. where Paul, I presume you're talking about rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your reasonableness be known to everyone. The Lord is at hand. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. Yeah, I mean, I think, and I often say that this is Paul actually doing cognitive therapy long before anyone else thought of it as that. But it's interesting how he sandwiches this comment about anxiety between the Lord is at hand, and then at the end, he says, and the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. So he's saying, be aware of the presence of God. Don't be anxious. He doesn't just stop there and say, stop it, don't do it. But you now have to put other thoughts in place. So I think in relation to mindfulness, that you become aware of your anxiety, and you're aware of it in your body, in your mind, and then you begin to say, there are other reasons. I don't need to be anxious like that. The Lord is at hand. The Lord is near me. I can rely on his presence. And I can think positively. He goes on, he says, whatever is true, honorable, just, pure, lovely, commendable, think about these things. Whatever you've learned and received and heard and seen me practice these things, and the God of peace will be with you. So I think Paul is saying, you can put other things in anxiety's place, and then you will subjectively know more peace. So that's a sort of combination. That's mindfulness-based cognitive therapy from a Christian perspective, I think. question about, think about these things. Yeah, I mean, I think it's right that we combine, as Christians, certainly we combine the mindfulness and the thinking and the cognitive-based stuff. Combining it with mindfulness is very important. We can't avoid thinking. It's just getting our thinking going in the right direction. And rather than just reacting, we need to slow down and be mindful of where our thinking is taking us in our actions and in our attitudes to other people. So maybe that is enough, do you think, Ovidio, for today?
Thank you so much, Dr. Richard, for this challenging webinar. We want to express our deep appreciation for sharing your mind and your heart with us. And may the peace of God that surpasses all our understanding, as you said, guard your heart and mind and ours as well in Christ.